It's always a delight to welcome my good friend, Dr. John Patrick, to the Christian Doctors Digest microphone. John actually lectures throughout the world, helping audiences, regardless of their beliefs, to understand the pivotal role played in all societies by faith and religion. And he's as comfortable talking to a Christian as a non-Christian audience in a large medical institution. He's been very active in the Christian Medical and Dental Association in Canada, as well as CMDA here in the United States. And what you might not know is he retired from the University of Ottawa in 2002 after 20 years as the associate professor in clinical nutrition and the departments of biochemistry and pediatrics. He's the president of Augustine College, great liberal arts college teaching the history of ideas. John and Sally also run the Registry for Hippocratic Physicians in Canada, something that is becoming more and more important. As you may have heard just recently, they found a right for physician-assisted suicide in the Canadian Constitution, and the CMDA of Canada is really fighting that, as they're even as going as far as to force doctors to refer for physician-assisted suicide. Well, let's don't take any more of John's time. He's got some great, important information to share with us. Welcome to the microphone. John, what's happening in the public square, and how do we continue to make a difference there? You've been so pivotal in helping us think strategically and to educate ourselves and learn how to engage. Update us on where things are and what we need to be doing.
Well, you know more about the nitty-gritty of day-to-day. I mean, I've been utterly appalled that in your last election, your president's attack on rights of conscience received virtually no coverage. And certainly for medicine, I think this is a fundamental area of change that we need to start thinking about a great deal. I had an email a couple of weeks ago from a medical student in Texas A&M, which I had thought of as almost a Christian medical school. And he said, in the surgery department, I was told to leave my conscience in the parking lot. That's terrifying.
Especially in the surgery department. You think of it maybe the OBGYN department, but,
this was surgery. And they said, if it's legal, it's your job to provide what the patient wants. Wow. Which is Obama's argument, accepted.
Yeah.
So the question we have to deal with is, where do we start in this discussion? Where's the beginning point? Now, one of the things I would like to see every CMDA doc in the country, you used to have those triangular blocks of wood with your name facing the patient.
Mm-hmm.
But on that block, I want, do you wish to be cared for by a doctor with or without moral integrity?
Mm.
You don't need to make a statement, just a question. And we have to ask it in our churches. We have to have everybody asking that question. Because what has happened, in my view anyway, and I'm stealing this straight from Leslie Newbegin, really. You probably read Pluralism and the Gospel in a Pluralistic Society some years ago, didn't you? Because mm-hmm. It came out, 89, I think it was. Every missionary should read it. But now the mission field is here. And he sets about teaching us how to talk to people in an explicitly Christian way, but without giving them offense in the way that they can take umbrage. And that's what we've got to learn to do in order to get back to the fundamentals. And there are several questions that help in this area. One that works beautifully, and again, we can use it in all sorts of settings, especially if you're talking to, say, the 25 to 35-year-old age group. I know you all hate divorce, and you can see the body language immediately. You know, people are appalled that you would say such an insensitive thing when so many people are divorced. But you can also see the second take where they say, but, and you can almost see the bubble over their head saying, but I do hate divorce. And they say, look, I know for those of you in this audience who have been in divorce yourself, that was a very upsetting statement. That wasn't the intent. My primary concern at this moment is the children. Children do not recover from divorce. That's why we're so uptight about spanking rules and all the rest. It's a cover-up for the deeper harm that we've done to children by not providing them, as our duty, a stable relationship within which they could grow up. Nobody can measure that, but we can certainly measure what happens when it isn't there. So divorce and the breakdown of marriage and children is one way we go at it. The other one is to actually wait in saying the things you and I will say. Somebody is going to say, I find that deeply offensive and intolerant. And my response is to say, it was not intended to be offensive, but it certainly is intolerant. Surely you are intolerant of many things too. So shouldn't the proper discussion be, what is appropriate intolerance? They expect me to apologize and close down when they use the word intolerance. I don't. And then we start a discussion, and I point out, Judaism has succeeded dramatically. Look at the Nobel Prizes. And it's based on what could be rewritten as the 10 divine intolerances. So maybe we need to rethink this. Tolerance is not even a virtue. It's a means of control in the modern world. The book to read is A.J. Conyers' book from Baylor on The Long Truce, How Tolerance Made the World Safe for Power and Profit. So history really matters. And it has to go back, really, to the 14th century. And I think when people see the whole history laid out, they realize what's happened to us. I mean, when people start a church now in many parts of America, they think about issues like location, don't they, as primary. So they'll do it in a shopping mall even, because they'll get passing trade, so to speak. That wasn't why it started in the first place. It started because people needed to come together to praise the Lord. And it was no small thing for them. Again, from that trip that I was telling you about just before we started recording to the Carolinas, I was given a book to read, which I'm working my way through, called Recalling the Hope of Glory by Alan Roth. And it's about rejuvenating worship to make it real. And that means it can't be about entitlement. We're not entitled to be happy. We are called to serve, and God will look after the happiness. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think, you know, if you've been following what's been going on in the U.S. as we're putting this recording together with the Ebola outbreak and bringing Kent Brantley and Nancy Ripoll back to the States, and, you know, all the controversy over that, and people just not understanding why in the world. I mean, he was even called an idiot by, you know, a conservative commentator, that he even went over there and did this and, you know, and that type of thing. People have such a foreign idea of what a heart of service is, or even what medicine is. I mean, let's go protect ourselves because this is dangerous for us versus what medicine's really about. I have a covenant relationship. I'm going to take care of you even if I put myself in danger, because that's what physicians do.
Yeah, but they don't think that anymore. I heard a student some years ago stop me in my tracks when he said, I'm not going to have anything to do with HIV. I don't want to die of HIV.
Yeah.
No, HIV is not that bad. Ebola's a different league. Yes, I remember the old guy who taught infectious diseases when I was a medical student. He recounted the number of his colleagues who, in infectious diseases, who had died. Because, of course, he was in the pre-antibiotic era.
Yeah. I remember the first HIV patient that I ever took care of in Africa back in the early 80s, and all we knew about HIV was, you got it, you died. And you're going into the operating room knowing that you're working in difficult situations with inadequate equipment and could stick yourself. I remember one of our surgeons stuck himself. We tested him a month, 2 months later. He was positive. Young guy with kids, and prayer, and a retest 2 months later, and it was negative. And don't ask me if it was a miracle or not. I assume it was, but that's what we do if we really love. That's what Christians have done through history.
Yes, and Galen was amazed at the Christians, because plague came to Rome, and he took off for his estates in Turkey. And he writes about the Christians who stayed and died.
Yeah.
But save many, because plague, you know, very basic hygiene, hydration, etc., can save a lot of people.
Yeah.
And they did that. And there's a beautiful novel, an Italian novel by a guy called Manzoni, called The Betrothed, which describes a plague epidemic in Italy. I don't know what the dates would be, 18th century perhaps, something like that. That was what medicine was. And nothing like it existed until after Christ came. Christ changed history. Within a couple of hundred years of Christ, we had what can clearly now be seen as the beginnings of hospitals.
Yeah.
I mean, there were monasteries and the like, and within 5 centuries, Benedict had given us a rule for living, and we had the much maligned Dark Ages, which actually purified Europe to the extent they got rid of slavery without any legal action. We don't know how to tell our story. That's the problem. We've got to learn to do it again.
I was educating some of our new medical missionaries. You know, we do orientation. We start another one in a couple of days, but we had Samaritan's Purse residents there, and one of the female doctors was going back to Liberia to work at Elwha, where Kent Brantley was infected, and everybody was, you know, this was heart in the news at the time, and as they were leaving, and I was trying to give them their challenge, I said to them, you know, if you die before you go, you won't have to worry about dying when you get there.
You could say that and get away with it. Yeah.
Well, it's true.
It's true. If you die, we should have died at baptism, shouldn't we?
Right. Well, it died in the sense that we have put it all in the altar, as Abraham put his son, and said, I'm going because God has called me, whatever that means. And that's what Kent Brantley did. And Kent and Amber, who were here last year for missionary training, I mean, by faith. And they went and they stayed even in the midst of the danger. And what a testimony that's been. People just can't explain it. That's why they're calling them idiots, because the Bible says we'll call people foolish when they do things like this.
Yeah. I put it in a rather more gentle way. I say, I'm not going to die 1 minute earlier in the middle of a rebellion than I am in Ottawa.
Yeah, that's true.
I die when the good Lord says so, not a moment earlier or a moment later.
So back to the public square. We're getting off topic here, but we're having a good time.
Well, I mean, so the conscience issue is huge, and we have got to do a lot more educating, because at the moment, basically, conscience is not being respected, and if we don't do something about that, we'll soon find large chunks of medicine no longer available to Christians. That's where we will need to rebuild within the context of the church. But in the interval, I think we've got to have a big discussion about democracy and justice. Mm. Not faith, but democracy and justice. We are a pluralistic world in which we do not agree about the nature of good and evil. But medicine is intrinsically a moral activity. We help people to decide what they ought to do. They do not have to take our advice. So when you have a moral activity in a world without moral agreement, you are inevitably going to have trouble. And the way out of that trouble has been worked out by the Catholics a long while ago. It has a name called subsidiarity, which most people have not heard of. But what their philosophers worked out was that when you don't have moral agreement over moral issues, you have to look for communities of moral agreement. Now, what's being proposed by Obamacare is that the liberal elite decide what is going to be the way we ought to practice medicine. How on earth do they make that claim and pretend to be Democrats? The truth of the matter is that approximately 50% of Americans are unashamedly pro-life, and the other 50% hang on the other side. That means that we ought to divide the budget up and give it out to organizations that can work from a point where they agree. So you have a just funding formula. You can use it either way around. I mean, this is in effect, without the government being involved, by hand with Hippocrates. It took 3 centuries or so, but the way Hippocrates and his guys did medicine, people could see you were more likely to come back alive from them. So in 3 or 4 centuries, it became the dominant way of doing things because people voted with their feet. And nobody challenged it then until the 19th century, and really not effectively to the middle of the 20th. So I think we do really need to think about how we're going to make politicians think about ways of running the hospital and medical system. I hate the term healthcare. Medicine is a much better term. But we need ways of running it which respect people's belief systems. And I do not see any way that you can say no to abortion or euthanasia to a society in which half the society thinks that it's a perfectly good and legitimate thing. When it's 51% one way or the other, imposing at that point seems to me foolish. as Paul puts it in Romans, when we make choices, God leaves us to work them out for ourselves. Do it your own way until you repent. Ezekiel 20 is the most striking chapter in that direction. And I think we need to talk about these difficult things. But the church will be the place where we begin again, probably, if we don't do it earlier. But why did we give up faith-based practice of medicine? I don't know. We didn't know how to deal with the politicians. I think that's what it amounted to. Yeah. Now, we don't want to go all the way to the Tea Party end of the spectrum and say government is entirely bad. It's not. Government is necessary. Read Scruton on that. Without government, you have anarchy. So we trade in some of our freedom in order to get peace. But within the context that we're in now, we're in fresh waters, new environments, and we need new solutions.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, there's such a high level of polarization. I know it's true in Canada, but more so perhaps in the U.S. because there's more an even division. But, you know, if people believe there's no right or wrong, then all that matters is who has the power. So I've got to get the power any way I can, because then I can get my way. And that's increasingly what we're seeing at the political level and the government level. And then I will impose my will upon you. And, you know, that ends up being a breakdown of democracy and not taking care of people that disagree with you in the same way that you take care of the people that do.
Yep. So we would not be allowed to do that. I say, when your doctor doesn't fear God, you better start fearing your doctor.
Mm.
Because when killing is legal, money changes hands when people die. There will be corruption.
Yeah.
Inevitably. So, but the point you make about power is absolutely right. It was recognized a long while ago by Arthur Leff in that famous article from Duke in 1979, where he comes to the conclusion that we're on our own. There is no God. He bends the knee to Darwin without mentioning him and says, but he's Jewish, so he's honest. He says, looking around the world, this is an extraordinarily unappetizing prospect. If brotherly love exists, the ruling model appears to be Cain and Abel.
Hmm.
Only if the law was unnatural and unspeakable by us would it be unchallengeable. As things stand now, everything is up for grabs. He recognizes, way back then, over 30 years ago, that it was going to become all about power. And the more modern faculties in the university acknowledge that straightforwardly. Black studies, women's studies, homosexual studies all say the law is about power, not about justice. And you can see that is so.
Interestingly, the people that are seeking the power always talk about justice.
Yeah, but they don't define it.
They don't define it, and they don't practice it. But they use it as the smokescreen or the fog to accomplish their goals.
They assume that everybody agrees on it, but we don't, because neither do we agree about freedom. You know, for us, freedom is the freedom to be what we ought. For the unbeliever, freedom is to do what I want.
Yeah.
That's very, very different, and it's not freedom. Because we all know, don't we, that as Christians, we have that wonderful entry into the kingdom, which Lewis describes with minor experiences of God which overwhelm them, but then the real work starts. Now we have to start working out what this is all about. In that book that I mentioned to you before, the start of this recording, George MacDonald's sermons, he has a wonderful account of the passage in Matthew about being come unto me all ye that heavy laden, and he made me rethink it in a way I ought to have done years ago, that we like the comfort, the idea, but he says, take my yoke upon you and then you will have peace. You can only have peace if you are yoked to me, if my character is going to guide what you do. Then you will be peaceful, you will be as you ought to be. The peace that we want is called anarchy, and it's not peace at all. And we need to model that, but we don't. I mean, you go into churches, it's not very convincing a lot of the time, is it? Who was it? I think it was Nietzsche who said, you must look more redeemed to me if I am to believe in your Redeemer. Hmm. Fair comment, I think.
Yeah. Well, you're a farmer, and, you know, with oxen, they actually make the yoke right for each oxen, but they always take a bigger ox to train a younger ox, and they
That's
put
right.
them in yoke together.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's the only way you can learn. And it's the same with us in our walk with Christ. It's being in that yoke with Him that teaches us what godly behavior is.
I mean, we say, but Lord, I can't do that. And He says, with me, you can. And we learn over time, don't we?
Yeah.
And you see it in Christians who learn it through challenges that I don't think I could handle. I remember a mom years ago who had three children with CF, all of whom were going to die before she did. But she handled it, and I met her years later and said, how have you managed it all? She said, if God had told me what He wanted me to do, I would have said it's impossible. But it's been all right. In fact, I have been blessed.
You don't learn to pull the plow by standing still.
No, not at all.
It's when the load is put on is when you really learn the lessons, and that's when you're really dependent on God, who's there yoked to you in that situation, and you're yoked to Him in the sense that you're depending on Him so much. And too often we look for the way of ease when God says, no, plow the hard ground, and that's when you'll learn of me.
And that's crazy, isn't it? I mean, we know. I watch my grandsons now, although they're not yet 20, the ones over 17 are all over 6 foot. They come to the farm, and I give them lots of hard physical labor, and they love it. At the end of the day, they're tired, they have a good meal, but it's an incredibly satisfying day.
Yeah.
We all know that working physically hard is good for us. It's also true, working metaphysically, if you like, and we don't do that anywhere near as well as we used to, do we?
No.
I mean, the school is, well, here's a phrase that when I was going to talk to you, came across it the other day. This is Roger Scruton talking about what's happening in the European Parliament. He says, activists in the European Parliament seek to impose on all states of the Union, regardless of culture, faith, or sovereignty, an unqualified right to abortion, together with forms of sex education calculated to prepare young people as commodities in the sexual market, rather than as responsible adults seeking commitment and love. That's a fair comment.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't what happened when you went to school. It wasn't what happened when I went to school. The assumption was that moral truth existed, and we were being trained to live it. And you can't do that without a great book in your life. Taking the Bible out of high school, the results were inevitable. There has to be a great book in everybody's life.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're hopeless.
Yeah, a set of principles that guide you and guides others. And unfortunately, we thought we could just guide, each person could guide themselves based on what they wanted or what they needed. And it's been a disaster, and we're seeing that road continue. Let's move into how do we look to the future. I mean, all of us understand the problem better just from listening to what you're saying. But, you know, you've mentioned that we've got to take the lead from churches. Anything else in the public square?
One of the things we've learned from the Augustine College experience is that they are like leaven. They are leavening the lump. They go off to university, and they have an impact.
Mm-hmm.
We need to start taking seriously preparing our young people for entering the university milieu, because if they're not properly prepared, they'll do as I did and go for a 20-year journey in the wilderness because nobody taught them how to deal with reductionism and relativism and tolerance and all the rest of it. He didn't hear it in church. So we need to pay attention to real education with the intent of firming up Christian commitment. Now, the project has succeeded dramatically. Sure, we have selection bias in the people who come in the first place. But those who come have something like a 90% probability of then going on to university and coming out with a faith that's better than when they went in. So we need to clone it, and any university town can do it. Now, I know that there's some folks have been to see me in Dallas who are thinking of trying to start it. The people in North Carolina, they've got people from the local university. We had a lovely meeting with the pastor and his men's group on Saturday morning and talked entirely about education for about 4 hours. And they're thinking about it. Chicago is thinking about it. So I think if we can give our young people the training in what are the right questions, how do I deal with these questions, it will fly. I was taken by surprise over the growth of the apologetics movement. I had missed it, being largely in the medical community, but about 2 years ago, I was in Vancouver to do something at the University of British Columbia and also to talk to the Christian medical student group there, which I do every time I go. And somebody up the Fraser Valley had looked at my calendar on the website, saw that I was in Vancouver, and realized it was going to happen at the time that they were running an apologetics conference. And he called me and said, could you come? And I said, sure. I didn't really ask many questions because he said, we have nobody covering how you deal with the bioethical issues. I said, that's fine. And I thought there might be 100 people. When I got there, there were over 2,000, and they were begging to be allowed in, and the fire department rules wouldn't allow them in. And they'd come from as far away as Montana. As a result of that, a few months later, I was at another one in Hamilton and another one on Vancouver Island. There are a lot of young people out there who are beginning to realize they've been sold a pup, but they don't know what the answers are. We've got a lot of education to do.
And what a great way, you know, you talk about Augustine College and kids taking a bridge year coming out of high school. What a opportunity to take a year and lay a firm foundation for whatever they're going to study, whether they're going
to do it later if you can't do it then. We had a doctor over both of the last 2 years, a Norwegian doctor who met me in Uruguay at the ICMDA meeting there, and he came. And next year we've got a medical student who's just finishing medicine in Finland, and we met in Lebanon. It's not confined to the bridge between home, Christian schools, and university. If you've got a young person in university who is being got at by the university, having their lives undermined, pay for them to take a year off and come and get it straightened out.
Yeah, you'll be the best money you've ever invested.
Oh, I'm no question. I'm very envious. I wish I'd had a course like that at their age.
Me too. And plus the fact that, you know, we are people listening to this are, you know, physicians, dentists, and other healthcare professionals. But this is something to suggest to your friends in your church and people that you know. This, you know, if you really care and see that this could be helpful with them dealing with their kids, what a great opportunity to put them on the right track. Let me ask you one more thing, John, before we cut this off. I hate to quit because I love to talk to you, but you're still available for speaking across the U.S. and tell us about that. I know you've been going all around the world, but you know, I think people need to hear that you're still available, and not only just for speaking to physician groups or healthcare groups.
Well, that's right. I love talking to the whole range, and increasingly I realize that we have been looking after our own needs within medicine and not realizing that our patients, our churches, our schools are in need too. So I'm very happy to speak to all those groups. In fact, I want to speak to them. I find the best use of my time is to be there for 3 or 4 days and ideally to come back a year later, because evangelicals have been used to having people come along who they don't want to take their friends in case they're embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they might be embarrassed by me. It'll be because it's a bit too harsh at times, but they won't be embarrassed in a way that they can't handle. And next time they bring their friends. So that's a better way to do it. Sally pointed this out years ago, but we're slowly getting around to it. So I was with Will Gunnels in Texas earlier this year, and I'm going again either the end of this year or the beginning of next. I can't remember. I think it's in September, but I don't do the booking, so Sally will tell me where I'm going. And that combination is really worthwhile doing. I'm sure you've discovered the same thing, that talking to you, you've got the mission string to your bow as well, but you've also watched what happens when education of young people is neglected from the Christian point of view. So we need to start having serious reading groups in churches, not the sort of, you know, double-spaced, make-you-feel-good stuff, but stuff you actually have to read and struggle with. And there's a whole list on my website of articles that you could take. If you just took the ones from First Things, they would give you a reading group. And when they start, they don't stop.
Yeah. Great discussions follow, and everybody learns.
Yeah.
So.
And there's lots of free material on both my website and on the college website, so augustinecollege.org and johnpatrick.ca.
John, thank you again for what you've done in inspiring us and training us and equipping us for ministry. You've been a blessing for many years. This all started 20 years ago, I think, when I first heard you on a tape. And yeah. God's done great things, and it's just been
marvelous.
We had
no idea what was going to happen, did we?
No, we didn't.
And you have done so much for us, for which we're all grateful. Everywhere I go, people tell me how much they appreciate what you're doing. So when you're hidden away doing the graft, I hope you know how much what you do is appreciated. And the Doctor's Digest it goes everywhere.
Yeah.
It doesn't just go to doctors. They give it to their friends, their pastors, and all the rest. And they call me quite frequently. So keep up the good work.
God bless you, John.
And you too. God bless.
Isn't it always great to sit down with John? I could just sit at his feet and ask questions. I don't know anybody that's more widely read or better synthesizes what he knows into practical things we can use in our day-to-day lives. I encourage you to go to those websites that he mentioned and look for the resources. Become a voracious reader on these important topics. They'll equip you better to do what God has called you to do every day.